Skull, everybody. This is Alexander Ludwig, and you are listening to The Wild Hunt.
Welcome back to The Wild Hunt, the No Ship Network podcast on the History Channel series Vikings. I am your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
If you like what you hear, go to our website at www.noship.net and check out all of the other podcasts that we cover. I'm sure you're going to find something you like there. We cover an awful lot of TV. So when you get there, you can also find the ways that you can support us. The biggest way that you can do it is leave a review on iTunes. We love reviews on iTunes.
And if you want to connect with us, you can sign up on the TV Time app. Also, you can communicate with us on our Facebook page and our Twitter pages. And thank you for those of you who have gone and rated our podcast. We've got a good turnout so far, so please keep them coming. If you haven't done it yet, it just takes a few minutes on iTunes to go and hit a couple stars or write something nice.
Give us some stars. It's giving us some love. Makes us more visible.
All right. So today we are discussing Vikings, Season 5, Episode 3. The episode is titled Homeland. This was written by Michael Hirst and directed by Steve St. Lager. I looked him up and it seems like he hasn't really done a lot at this point. He is credited for directing a movie called Lockout. He also has writing credits for that. And this movie starred Guy Pearce.
I don't think I've ever heard of that, Lockout.
I haven't heard of it.
Yeah. No, but that doesn't mean anything. There's a ton of movies that come and go that I don't know anything about.
So just like the first two episodes that we discussed for Season 5, we're going to break the recap up into characters. So we're starting with Bjorn and Halfdan. It is night during this first scene with Bjorn's storyline. Bjorn wants to know from Halfdan what he wants to achieve. Halfdan wants to live his life to the fullest, essentially. Sinric interrupts their discussion to suggest that Bjorn send some of his boats home. This way they appear as traitors and not as raiders. Bjorn worries this would make them vulnerable, and Sinric says it is better to be naked than dead.
Okay, so first question I've got is, where the hell did Sinric come from? The last time we saw him, he was telling Rollo, listen, if you want me to hang out with you, you know, and talk to you and be your buddy here in this place where nobody really likes you, you're basically going to have to cut off my feet to make me stay because, yeah. You know, I wander around the world, I do my thing, I go and I say funny stuff and be myself, and that's that, I'm gone. And then now he's with Bjorn and Halfdan going to the Mediterranean. The only thing I can think of is that if you guys remember from last season, that's when they hooked up with Rollo, is when they went to the Mediterranean. So if they're going past Normandy again, we're just going to assume that Sinric was still in the area and he kind of thumbed a ride.
Yeah, he's on the beach.
Yeah.
You know, he Ubered a Viking.
Don't panic towel.
Uber Vikings.
So do you guys think that he's going to leave the ships behind?
Yeah, he seems concerned about doing it, so I'm not really quite sure. I mean, is it even good advice? It might be, but then he would be vulnerable for attack.
I mean, I can kind of see it both ways. You know, Bjorn feels naked, and I see that. You know what I mean? But at the same time, if you look like you're bringing a war fleet in, everybody is just going to get, like, they're going to get on war footing and try to fight you, obviously, right? So if they have that capability, they're going to do it. So I kind of see just bringing three ships in. And if you seem like traitors, you can get a feel for everything. You know what I mean? It's not quite infiltration, but like a scouting thing or get in there and get a lay of the land and see what there is to see.
Yeah.
Has word spread about their last attack and people are keeping an eye out?
Oh, I'm sure it has.
Watch out for the tall white dudes with beards. You know, they're not nice. They're not friendly.
At first, it didn't seem like it was the same actor that played Sinric. In fact, I was like, is that Michael Hirst doing a cameo? Oh my goodness. Who is that guy? Because he kind of looked like Michael Hirst for a second.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, he's changed.
Well, last time we
up.
Saw, yeah, because didn't he have long hair last time? I'm pretty sure it was like long white hair.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know if it was a wig that, I mean, obviously it was a wig for the actor, but I don't know if it was Sinric, the character, wears different wigs and or just, you know, kind of changes style from now and again.
Yeah, it looked like he had the Caesar, you know, so it was interesting to see him, you know, go in.
I like, I have to say, the conversation between Halfdan and Bjorn was good, though, because the contrast between the way that Halfdan wants to live and the way his brother is, I like that. Because, you know, his brother has all these lofty ambitions and Halfdan's just like, you know, I just want to get out there and see what the world has to offer, live for the day, live my life to the fullest, and then, you know, die satisfied doing that. Because, I mean, it's a good point because, you know, I don't consider myself to be a supremely ambitious person where it's like, I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do that, then I'm going to do that. I'm driven to whatever goals I do have. But other than that, it's kind of like, yeah, all right, I can kind of go along to get along. So it's nice to see that with somebody else too.
And it really complicates things if my theory is true about Halfdan being the one to kill Lagertha later.
Oh, yeah.
Almost makes me feel like my theory is right. Because that would be really great dramatic tension.
I just don't want to think about that. I don't want to think about Lagertha dying.
She's not.
But you're probably right. Yeah, she's not. Mm-hmm. We'll be all like the people like last season. Ragnar's not going to die. He's not going to die. He's going to come back. He's going to come back.
All right, so up next we are discussing Floki. Floki is less celebratory since we last saw him as he is still navigating the terrain of Iceland. He looks at his wound and sniffs it for rot. He dips a cloth in groundwater and applies it to his hand. Later, Floki reassesses his wound and seems disappointed with its development. He calls out to the Allfather, wanting to know why he was brought there. He sees a vision of who I think is Hel, and then of possibly a Valkyrie. He falls to the ground, now believing he was brought there to die in peace. He experiences something that is hard to put into words, but it appears to be both painful and ecstatic at once. When he comes to, his wound has healed, and he shouts in celebratory fashion, believing he is in Asgard.
All right, so the question here is there really, I mean, he's in Iceland, not Asgard. Yeah. So is there really magic afoot, or is he hallucinating because of this wound?
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then how does it just disappear like that?
He could have hallucinated that too.
Yeah, he could have hallucinated the wound in the first place.
Yeah, because we haven't seen him eat or mm-hmm. anything. No. You know, he's drank a little puddle of water on the beach. So there's no telling. Yeah, there's no telling what's going on. You know?
I mean, I definitely wouldn't, if I was him, I definitely wouldn't be dehydrated. I might not eat anything depending, but I mean there's all those waterfalls that just stand underneath and let it fall into your mouth, and there's no reason for him to be dehydrated. Mm. But you know, you never know. It's still beautiful. That's the thing about this episode. It's kind of got mixed reviews, but whatever bad you might be able to say about it visually, it's just stirring. You know, it's stunning, really. Like the way this episode is as beautiful and bloody as anything that the, you know, Vikings have done so far, I think.
Even if hallucinating or not, Iceland looks otherworldly. And I think it's mostly due to its mineral content. They have those hot springs that are mineral blue with the equally blue plume that float above it, and just these like interesting colored striations at the banks of bodies of water, and volcanic activity everywhere. And it looks amazing, like another planet.
I think I've seen pictures of that like in National Geographic of like people bathing in those. Mm-hmm. But I definitely want to go. So I can't blame him. You know, if you're seeing stuff like that, well, he saw the volcano, so he's got to be like, what the hell is this? You know, you got to feel like you're in the land of the gods at that point.
Well, some of those hot springs are vast, and they have spas that they have set up next to them because they're considered healthful. So people go there to recuperate. So what is it going to take to have Floki break out of this hallucination or belief that he has?
He's going to have to meet somebody else.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know if there'll be anybody there.
No, exactly. I don't think he's going to come out of it until he goes back and tries to get people to come back and settle. You know what I mean? I mean, unless he just stays there by himself, and we know that's not, you know, how it happens. So I feel like he's got to travel back and to convince people to come, and then maybe they'll convince him that it's not Valhalla, but at least they'll see the potential that Iceland has for him, you know?
I mean, there's got to be just as much, you know, land for farming there as there is in Scandinavia, or more.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, which is, aside from raiding, is part of the reason why they leave in the first place. I mean, that's what Uba's trying to do pretty much altogether, is just trying to get a farming mm-hmm. plot established, kind of almost at the expense of everything else. But we'll get to that.
Yeah, it's kind of, we're getting treated to everybody's kind of mission in life. Floki's always been on this track. I think Helga was probably a bit of a distraction, but at the same time, she was a passenger along his particular path towards his destiny. I like the fact that Michael Hurst is showing us this madman of like who goes on these religious walkabouts in a way.
Yeah, I love it.
Floki.
I look forward to the Floki scenes because I know that it's just going to be you're going to have this breathtaking landscape, and it's going to be real. Just I mean, Gustav Skarsgård is just awesome. Because, I mean, he could just pull that off. Like, he's not interacting with anybody. It's all just him doing make-believe, you know, mm-hmm. being the consummate actor and seeing this stuff and going, okay, and then I'm going to react like this. And he pulls it off, though. I can't think of, maybe Travis Fimmel could do it too, but I can't think of very many other people on the show who would you would want to see somewhere by themselves for long periods of time, because it would just start to drag.
We saw Bjorn for a while by himself when he was...
There was a bear.
And an assassin.
Yeah, and an assassin. That's right. Yeah.
So, anything else about Floki before we move on?
It is one of the things I fell in love with the show. You know, like at the very first episode when you see Ragnar and his brother fighting, and then it's that mystic element that's always nice that they add in. Mm-hmm. It seems like every other season we'll get it. So, it was cool that they added it into this one and to see how it's going to play out for the rest of the season. You know, is he going to keep it?
Well, you know, one of the things that I like, Floki is a link spiritually to some of the stuff that the show has kind of shed, because it's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger and encompassing more characters, more different lands, mm-hmm. and more storylines all at the same time. So it left this element behind by necessity. But remember when you would have the scenes in the earlier seasons where they would show you kind of like the Viking life and the rituals that they did, and you'd have Wardruna playing in the background, and it mm-hmm. would be these grand scenes and maybe a sacrifice, like the stuff that happened at Uppsala and things like that. And there would always be one or two of those in every season, and they kind of stopped doing that. And so Floki, and I really like those scenes, so Floki to me kind of provides a connection back to that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's why I enjoy his scenes so much.
Is Wardruna still providing music?
I don't know if they are or not. I haven't seen their name in the credits, because their sound is really specific. Mm-hmm. So it's everything now is done. It sounds like, you know, TV show cinematic style, which isn't mm-hmm. bad, but it's different, separate from Wardruna.
Now we're going to discuss Astrid and Harald. Astrid is introduced to Harald's homeland, and as their boat is coming into shore, he takes a deep breath, and he's taken in all the stink, but it smells like home to him. And after disembarking the boats, she has to step over fish guts and many meaty remains. She says she does not like the look of the place. Despite the untidiness, the town seems to love their leader, for Harald is greeted robustly upon his return. Harald reports to his people the recent successes abroad and Halfdan's decision to adventure with Bjorn Ironsides. More importantly, he reminds his people of his dream to make this town the capital of Norway, and that Astrid is also a part of this stated vision. This is where he introduces her. She goes along with Harald because what else can she do? Later, Astrid is a prisoner in her own room. Women bring in clothes and jewels for her to wear. Harald is celebrating with his people. Concerned with Astrid's tardiness, he asks why she has not come. It is reported that she refuses. Just as his face begins to purple with anger, Astrid makes her entrance, lighting his face back up. Later, she is tired and excuses herself and thanks Harald for the feast. He soon follows, making much display of this before his people, to their delight. In her room, he kisses her. It is when he chuckles in her face, like he just proved something, is when she breaks his nose. Again, before his people, with his bloody nose, he makes light of his wound by saying he has no luck with women. This again delights his people. I've got two hashtag no ships commenting on this scene before we discuss it. We have Michael Guy saying, well, that town was shitty, hashtag no ship. And Christian Callahan saying, Astrid looks as happy as Melania does sitting on that throne, hashtag no ship. She doesn't have the help me eyes yet, but.
The help me eyes.
There's still time for that.
Yeah, this town sucks. This town is just like the like crappy ghetto version of Kattegat. You know, like nobody's cleaning up after themselves. There's just like shit all over the walkways. You know, Kattegat's like nice and tidy and clean, but this is just like, yeah, just leave that out. We're going to drink some beer later. Don't worry about it. We'll get drunk and forget. And, you know, she notices it like immediately. But this scene, there's a lot of humor in this scene. Mm-hmm. I like upon rewatch, it had me laughing out mm-hmm. loud. Like not kind of like just laughed a little bit the first time. But the second time I saw it, I was laughing out loud when he gets his
sleeve,
the sleeve stuck on the door. He's all trying to look, you know, slick. And he's just like, hey, and his sleeve gets stuck. And then she punches him. And it almost reminded me of like the original Indiana Jones and the Lost Ark when him and Marion are going back and forth. Like I could just see the two replaced, you know, like you see Harrison Ford laugh and then you see her hit him. It felt like that kind of dynamic.
Yeah, I think the camera angles were chosen based maybe on a comedic style that they would use in comedies, especially when she punched him, because it was a low angle. And then when you see her eyes go wide right before she sent that slug into his face, that was hilarious.
And she telegraphed that thing
yeah.
a week ahead of time. She was just like, ready, here it comes.
And then he's drinking I figured you want to mention
oh
that.
Oh my God. The cup. When he comes back and he sits back on his throne and he has that cup.
Yeah.
I'm 6 foot tall. I could take a bath in that cup. That thing is huge. It was monstrous. It was ridiculous. And I'm just wondering if this is, it's like, that's the king's cup. That's why it's got to be so big. Or if they're just doing this to exaggerate stuff and just like kind of extend the comedy out.
Well,
I don't know.
That's just how he parties, you know? He just wants a big cup. I don't have to refill it more than once.
I think he might have like grabbed the tankard or the jug that they used to fill other cups. Mm-hmm. But it reminded me of Naked Gun. Like that sort of exaggerated comedy.
I feel like there's some tells here on Astrid's behavior, though. I think she's going to take the deal eventually. I might be alone on this just because of the way she's kind of testing things. You know, if she wasn't going to do it at all, she would put up more of a fight and not put the clothes and the jewelry on and go outside for a little while and see how the party's going. And then she goes back to her room when she's like, okay, this is kind of lame. I'm going to go back to my room. Then when he comes in, she kind of tested him on how he would act because she's been with some top-notch lovers, you might say, in the last few years. So I felt like she was just kind of seeing where things were going, you know. So she lets him, you know, she lets him kiss her, and then of course he laughs and she's gonna punch him in the face. So I feel like she's just kind of seeing what this guy's actual what he's made of. Like, is he full of shit? Does he have a lot of lands? Because even at the beginning when they land, she's like, oh, is this it? He's like, oh, this is just an outlier. You know, I've got a lot of land that I'm dealing with. This is just a small town. Then he goes into town and tells them what they want to hear. He doesn't cause ruffles. He's like, yeah, you guys are going to be the, he probably says it to every village. This is going to be the capital of Norway. This is going to be the capital of Norway. So I do.
I didn't think of that.
I hope so. I hope we see a scene of him saying that.
I didn't think about that while I was watching it, but it makes sense now. Mm-hmm. He's just being slick to every place he goes. He's like, you know, I'll make this the capital of Norway, you know, and everybody's like, yeah, Harald's our king. And then two towns over, he's just like, you guys are it.
Yeah.
You are my crowd. You're the ones.
Because even when it goes bad for him with her, he comes back and tells them kind of what they want to hear. I'm going to make fun of myself. I'm going to own it. I am terrible with women. Let's get fucked up. You know, so it was very, I feel like eventually we're going to see him go further and further into his actual homeland, you know, where his bed and castle is, or his actual town, and maybe see it grow and possibly give her a reason to stay. Cause I feel like she could have gotten away by now, or even just fought a little harder. She could be waiting to see if Lagertha and them come after him to her, you know, right now. I think she's weighing out her options just because of the last meeting she had with them, you know? So it's interesting.
It could be that Astrid could go over to see his side of things. I don't know if that's a, you know, what's going to happen. I mean, I talked about it on the last podcast, how I think, you know, maybe she is kind of breaking down a little bit when she was on the boat. Like, you could see that. I said you could see that, like, twinkle in her eye, and the gears are moving and stuff like that. But, you know, he went a long way to, I think he was, he made fun of himself. He took a broken nose in the bedroom and then went right back out and started drinking. Whereas, you know, we've seen this guy participate in rape before. Mm-hmm. So he's showing her some sort of respect and kind of saying, okay, well, we can let this develop as naturally as it can develop between, you know, a captive and their captor sort of thing. Yeah. But I'll just wait for you to get the Stockholm syndrome, you know.
Well, I mean,
and then we'll go from there.
She knows her station with Lagertha. We saw in that last argument. She's like, you know, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And then when she was with Bjorn right before he left, I'm sure there was some hoping that possibly she could. And I mean, I don't know what her intentions are, but it does seem like she's got her sights set pretty high. And then when he comes back and says, oh, he says, you know, Bjorn says hello to everybody but her, you know, it could set that off, you know. And then when Torvi tells her, well, you know, sometimes women have to do what they have to get a little power in life, all that could be weighing on her in into it all. I think she's sitting there waiting to see what the situation's going to turn out to be. And could it possibly be something that, you know, she can use to her own advantage? I could be totally wrong.
So too. Like Torvi saying that was basically setting the tone for Astrid's storyline from here on.
Yeah, kind of like a little foreshadowing.
Like she's having to she's having to discover that she does have to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to hold out because I want to have someone not betray Lagertha. And it would be great if it's Astrid.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm thinking that maybe she's doing as little as she can to pull Harold's strings just so she can keep herself safe and keep himself satisfied, and it's like walking a tightrope.
Yeah.
That's what I think she's doing right now.
I mean, it could be double agent also. She could be there to protect Lagertha, like at the last minute send a message over saying, look, these guys, you know, they're coming with an army to get you. That would be the best if she just kind of like fooled all of us and was playing double agent because she knew she can get information for her. That'd be fantastic.
Kind of like season three Floki. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Would it be that, you know, we thought that he was, you know,
yeah,
turning over to the other side, and then at the end, he comes right back around at the last minute, mm-hmm, and you're like, suckers. I think it was season three, but
I think it was too. That's mm-hmm. that's a good point. Mm-hmm.
But if Astrid does kind of get onto this honestly, you know, and goes along with the plan and everything with King Harold and his wife and all that stuff, I think that Lagertha will be okay, because that's where Ube's going right now. And I think there's going to be a little bit of, you know, hooking up action going on. Maybe not necessarily sexually, but maybe that too. And I think that that's where he's headed toward. Well, we know he's headed towards Kattegat, but mm-hmm, I'm thinking that
confrontation that turns into sex.
No. They're going to start fighting, and then it's going to turn into sex.
They're going to be rolling around and humping.
They're going to join forces, I think, is what's going to happen. And he's going to be the Ragnar son that she can trust, and it'll be born out of his kind of leaving Ivar. So then everything will just become more and more fractured. There's all these different alliances. Because I have no doubt that once Ivar has achieved a certain amount of goals in England, he's going to go back and try to avenge the death of his mother. That's still like on his plate.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with that completely. He's definitely got an agenda.
And then so if he comes back and his brother's there, it would just make it so much better for us as the viewers to see that go on.
You know? Oh, yeah.
I definitely think there's a leadership conversation happening still, because that happened in the previous two episodes, as we discussed. And I think showing the dirtiness of Harold's rule, like if there's going to be pestilence that happens, it's going to happen where Harold rules, not where Lagertha rules, you know. Right? But his people tend to love him more, so it just seems to me that's a kind of a sad truth about how we are with our leaders, and maybe we should examine ourselves as voters as we should examine our leaders as well. But
not keeping a tidy house over there, Harold. Not keeping a tidy house.
I'm sure there's a history of leaders who were, you know, became leaders just because of popularity and not really because they were effective.
No. It never happens. Especially not in America in 2017.
Next up, we're discussing the Saxons, the scenes that are leading up to battle anyway. And the Saxons of note are feasting together. The scene is purposely set to cause one to recall the Last Supper. The news is brought before them that the Norsemen have not secured the Roman walls of the town as suspected by Haman last episode. It is decided that tomorrow they will attack. They stand and cross themselves in unison. This underscores the unity within their vision and leadership, unlike the Vikings that have taken over York. And it ends with Haman saying, may the Lord be with us. And we have this quick cut to Ivar, which is following another scene, which I'll talk about later. But I wanted to mention that quick cut because there's some interesting editing choices that we'll probably discuss when we finish discussing the entire episode. So we'll just put a pin in that. The next time we are with the Saxons, they prepare for battle with prayer. Judith puts on a brave face, encouraging her sons to care for each other and to do their duty. As soon as they depart, her fear rises to the surface.
I'm surprised that they're sending the boys in, to be honest with you, against the Vikings. You think that because he's the king that you would leave at least one of the heirs back at camp. You know what I mean? It would make sense, because if it goes bad, which it has against the Vikings, you could lose all three. And then she'll be the queen. So then there you go. Never mind. There is somebody still left in the lineage. I forgot about Judith. So never mind. We've got Judith. She was queen.
She was crying with tears of joy. They're all going to die and I get to be queen. This is awesome. This is so fucking awesome.
I mean, is that how it would normally go? Is that the kings would be in the fray?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on what, like, I mean, if you're going like the King Arthur route, yeah. But then if you go, I don't know. I think it makes for good television. Yeah, mm-hmm. But I really don't know how that was done. And I think it probably varied from society to society and even within societies with different times.
It's different kings, you know? Different monarchs that don't want to fight like Ayla, you know, so you would have.
Right.
They would be comfortably back. But that's why Aethelwulf has such a strong reputation. You know, his dad was always sending him, hoping he'd get killed. So he's got quite the battle record.
Well, yeah, he was Operation Human Shield. So it's like, you know, his dad tried to get him killed as many times as he could, and it never happened. And he, you know, hell, you survive all that, you become a good warrior, I guess, just by. And I mean, he was kicking some ass.
Oh, yeah.
In this,
absolutely,
he was airwolfing it up. So.
Dream Wolf. So next we're going to discuss the Vikings, unless you guys had more to say.
No, I'm good.
And the Viking scenes are the ones leading up to the battle here. We are establishing York with an overhead shot, and there's actually a number of overhead shots of York in this episode. Ivar sits on a throne when a slave woman is brought before him. It looks like he has turned the cathedral into his personal place of rule, like he's... I think that was the altar behind him, and I think those are the cross windows that are behind him in the scene that we see later at the end of the episode.
It's definitely Ivar HQ at this point. I could see his skull back there on the altar amidst all the candles and stuff. So he's kind of – he wants to be the leader, but he's acting like a gothic teenager too. So, you know, it's a little
– Well, his brothers should have taken note on this also. You know, okay, there's not three chairs there. There's just one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're probably used to this with him, you know, so they just kind of, I think maybe at this point in the episode, they were just kind of placating him, going, okay, yeah, whatever. Have your throne room. We're going to go and try and find information.
Yeah, we're going to do work. So.
So at first I thought this slave girl resembled Margaret, which made me fear for her life at first. Ivar is surprised by her lack of fear. She is willing to offer herself as a sacrifice. In fact, she's willing to do anything he asks. He tests this by asking her to take off her clothes, then to come over to him, and then to kiss him. She does all this without hesitation or fear. There's a shot of his hand on the arm of his chair as she moves her hand down between his legs, and his hand tightens up just a little bit on there because I think he was fearing what her reaction would be, and he was probably ready to strike her or something, like just getting that muscle action about to go. But instead, she tells him that the gods have chosen him and that he is destined for greatness. She knows this because he is crippled. She says this is an outward sign of divine influence. As a result, he ends up giving her his freedom. So this is an obvious point of character shift for Ivar. Is this what fortifies him in his belief in his role as Ragnar was fortified because he believed himself to be the son of Odin?
I think this is this scene does a couple of things, in my opinion. It gives a finality to the question of Ivar's sexuality. I don't think it's going to be touched on again. No pun intended. I think that this is going to be... Anyway, I don't think that this is going to be an issue. We're not going to have an endless stream of scenes over the course of however many more seasons where women try to seduce him or he tries to have sex. I think this was a capstone on that. Mm-hmm. And what you had is a slave girl that did look strikingly like Margaret, and she was the exact opposite. She was not afraid of him at all. She went right up to him, kissed him, told him that he was special instead of cowering in fear. And, you know, whatever else, she was the exact opposite. So it's almost like he was able to have a certain amount of catharsis about his situation and come out the other end positive with it. I'm sure he's still not happy that he can't get it up and have sex, but he's at the point where he accepts who he is. And now he has that sign from the gods. I think that is a sign from the gods. And now he's ready to go to battle. And I'm glad that they did this scene. Because in last episode, when he was talking about being on equal footing with his brothers, it felt as though he was dismissing all of the stuff that Ragnar had told him in his last scenes with Ragnar in the previous season about how Ragnar said, "You are special. You are different. I wouldn't have chosen any of your brothers to do this with me, but I chose you." And he kind of pushed that to the wayside and was, you know, but now it's back. And so he has the reaffirmation that he needed to go forward and be this ruthless villain leader that he is.
I feel like that's been driving him this whole time. I don't think he pushed it to the side. I think it's what's been driving him, because when when he tells his brothers, look, I've always got to do things better than y'all do just because I have to, it's the only way I'm going to earn respect. So I have to be a little more vicious. I have to be a better fighter. I have to do things better because people see me this way. So when she comes in and acts this way, it might be the first time anybody's ever given him genuine respect the first time he's ever met him. You know what I mean? She really treats him and lifts him up to where she sold me on it to where it's genuine. So he's like, you can go free, you know? And I think that's how, if everybody treated him that way, Ivar wouldn't be as malicious as he is now because of the society that he's in. So, you know, he kind of tells his brothers what's pushing him. You know, he's like, yeah, I need these guards. I need these people around me, you know, because it shows that I'm that valuable and it's not that I need them to protect me. It's that I'm growing in power. This is showing everybody and all the other Vikings that these guys are loyal to me, you know? So he really is trying to just build up his reputation, you know? So when she comes at him like that, it was a tell for me that, okay, this is the real Ivar that's buried deep down inside of all the other walls that he's built up around him because of how he feels he has to earn his station in life.
Yeah, because he's surprised twice by her lack of fear. Mm-hmm. And I think that was just as moving as her declaration that he's been chosen by the gods.
Yeah, I like all that. I can totally, totally dig that. I one other thing I'd like to say too is that like she got her freedom because he got his, I think.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
now he's yeah. free of all of that bullshit that was being a mental block in his mind. She Tony Robbins his ass. You know what I mean? He was just like, and now he's like, okay, you did this for me. Now you go free because you're special, girl.
I'm surprised he didn't try to marry her. Like, fuck it. You know, I was like, he just found himself a queen.
Well, one of my questions was, will we see her again? But then when you started putting your idea forth, I was like, well, probably not, because if this is the capstone on any sort of discussion about his sexuality, then we won't see her again.
And this show has plenty of sex, so it's okay to have one character that's not going to have a sexual element to them. You kind of already have Floki there, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, but outside of him, because he's kind of taken on the elder statesman role. If they have too many things with him, it's going to be like King Ekbert in the bathtub. It's going to be gross, you know. So they you don't really want to see that. But so it's good to have another main character who's a little bit younger, not have the sexuality attached too much to what's going on, and we could just get some story out of him, you know.
Plus, I don't think he would keep her around because it could be a weakness for him, you know, with everything else he's got going on. The last thing he would need would be to worry about her or even somebody to capture her and use it as leverage against him, you know, because knowing him, he would not do whatever they asked to get her back. He would just end up letting
her die. At some point, she'd probably cease to be as Tony Robbins and probably turn into Rasputin or something.
Yeah. She would find like a, that would be an interesting twist though, if they did, and she kind of used him in her own ways, and you know, you had a season of that, and then he figures it out, and then it'd be just bad news. But
I do like the idea that being touched by the gods brings both a blessing and a curse, which is not an uncommon, you know, idea or theme. I imagine, though, an enormous finger coming down from the sky and lightly touching Ivar, making his legs curl like the Wicked Witch, but with like an ecstatic delight on his face.
Like a smush.
And maybe, you know, when we saw Floki last, which we've already discussed, like when he was having that, I couldn't hardly describe it in words, but he seemed like in pain and ecstatic at the same time. Is there going to be something that develops because of that? Because maybe he was really touched by the gods in some way, or maybe it is a hallucination. We'll see.
Starts turning into Floki's, the seer.
Floki, yeah, finally, like we thought was going to happen, which was a dead end.
Well, maybe. Maybe that is what it is. And that would... would be happy with that because it was so strange that they started to set that up and then they just dropped it.
That would be awesome if he has like a whole season of just soul searching on Iceland and then he goes back to Kattegat and then he, you know, the seer's either dead or not there, or, you know, he gets his walking papers. You're fired. What's the rune for fired? You know, just like slap that down in front of the tent.
Yeah, we're going to need this hut.
So we're going to take a break from discussing the Vikings and the Saxons, and we're going to talk about the battle. So again, we have overshots establishing York for this scene. The Roman walls crumble as the Saxons bore their way through the weak points into York. The Ragnarssons watch because they knew this would happen all along. Once inside, the Saxons divide their forces and begin to make their way towards the cathedral. Smoke obscures and arrows fly as they rush inwards, falling into sunken holes filled with deadly spikes. They have no choice but to stomp on their fallen in order to get across. Meanwhile, Ivar continues to observe from above, cloaked like a villain. Haemon stands ready for battle with his force behind him. He asks the Lord to forgive the work he must do this day. Arrows fly past him as if he is fated for something else. Some of Haemon's men are set ablaze. Fitzirk and Ube fight within the fray. Aethelwulf and his sons are also in the combat, and we see that Aethelwulf is a great guardian to his sons. Ivar watches Aethelwulf and sons and then turns to look at his helmet. He seems unsure. Ivar is now on his chariot, speeding towards the tumult when he is quickly expelled from his vehicle. He brutalizes the one responsible to death. Ivar, his face bloodied, crawls to his chariot and props himself up against it. Before him, a large contingent of armed Saxons, and one sends an arrow his way and barely misses. Ivar throws an axe in retaliation, and you can hear it thunk, and then you hear something drop. You don't... Ivar begins to scream in his native tongue about how he can't be killed, and that his name is Ivar the Boneless. Ube now comes out with men behind him, and he pauses to what? Assess his brother to see if one of the Saxons would kill him. Maybe he paused long enough to pass scrutiny and then lead his men out into battle to save Ivar. I don't know. Also, why didn't the Saxons put a little bit more effort into taking Ivar out? This is one of my nitpicks, actually, about this episode. Even Haemon gave up on that idea rather easily. It was like he was super easily distracted. A big crowd walks in front of him, and he's like, oh, never mind.
Mm-hmm. What was I doing? Oh, yeah, we were retreating. That's it.
I think we're supposed to believe that Ivar is so frightening, and I think we had talked a little bit about the fear-mongering and maybe how possibly Haemon was trying to lessen the fear about the Vikings among his soldiers with that one comment he had. Mm-hmm. But he may actually have that fear himself, and that's why he backed off.
I don't blame him, though. I mean, as much prowess as Haemon has as a warrior, Ivar strikes a pretty, you know, intimidating figure. He's just, like, insane. And he's got blood coming down off his face, you know, and he's not even moving. He's like, immobile. His legs don't work, and it's just like, god damn it, what is this, like, supernatural creature over here?
So. Yeah, the only way I can explain to myself the reason why people didn't send some more arrows his way is that they were just immobilized with fear. They just saw him effortlessly, or seemingly effortlessly, you know, chuck that axe at somebody and take him down.
If I was an English soldier and I had the bloodlust on, I think that I probably would have fired some arrows.
Yeah,
I'm just saying that for myself.
Yes, a crossbow, so it's kind something.
Yeah, exactly. It's a nitpick on my part too. I'm with you.
He's a literal sitting target.
Yeah, yeah. And he could throw shield at him. I mean, really, you can throw anything at him. He's not going to dodge too much.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, where he can move maybe a foot either way if he's just pivoting from the waist mm-hmm. up, maybe. You know, maybe a little more. That's
went in close quarters, nobody really got on him or anything. No. They kind of gave him like a pretty wide berth, and it's like, okay, well, I'll just while it's going on, I just chalked it up to storytelling. It's like, okay, we can't let Ivar get trampled. I think it would have been better if they had left him up in the tower watching, you know, personally, but, you know, maybe because this happens, this is what pulls the rest of the warriors with him, that he stood in front of them, you know, shouting at them and causing fear, that when all the other Vikings came around the corner, this is the what, you know, is the catalyst that pulls them all together at the end of the episode before they leave. Like, okay, look, I'm not afraid. Why are my brothers and them afraid? So that's what I'm just kind of hoping. Otherwise, I mean, yeah, somebody should have thrown a boot at him, something, you know, it would have at least shut him up a little bit, anything.
So what do you guys think took Ivar so long to join the battle?
I think it was hesitation. You know, it's in close quarters like that with walls and stuff. His chariot's going to do a lot of damage to his countrymen, and he's vulnerable if he falls off at all, because, you know, and a nice open field, he can move around and do more damage. I think he was actually contemplating whether or not he should go down there and be vulnerable.
Yeah, I think there's also an element of he wanted to wait because this was his plan that he wanted to see unfold. So if he's like Darth Sidious sitting up there with his cloak, you know what I mean? Just watching everything. And he's like, I'll be sending my apprentice Fitzurk, you know, just to like, so he's wanting to, he puts a lot of pride into the strategy and the cunning that he's showing. And he did a good job because he took the, you know, the Aethelwulf and Haemon think that they're doing something good by going through the Roman walls. Mm-hmm. And it's like,
oh, yeah,
he knew they were going to do that mm-hmm. before they knew it. He was like, yeah, there they are right there. I see you guys.
Told you.
And so it's like, yeah, see, you owe me, you owe me. But so I think there was an element of him wanting to watch his plan unfold so he could pat himself on the back and be like, yeah. And then I think that his blood started to get up when he saw all this going on and he looks over at the helmet. But the first thing I'm thinking is I have that song in my head, as I'm thinking Chariots of Ivar, you know, dun, 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 dun. Like, it's totally silly, but it's what was going through my head when I was seeing it.
I like that. I like that idea that he wanted to see his plan come to fruition. I think that's great.
And the way that this whole, all of the battle stuff was filmed, from the spikes going through that guy's throat and people's hands and them stepping over their other soldiers, you know what I mean, to get to safety and stuff like mm-hmm. that, all the way to the way that they were filming Ivar when he was screaming, because if you did that wrong, that scene would be laughable.
Yeah.
You know, if you just filmed it straight and just had him sitting there screaming, it would, you'd kind of just start chuckling through nervous laughter because you'd be like, what are they doing? What am I watching here? But as it was super effective.
We have two hashtag no shifts. Michael Guy says, you can always tell when a show's budget increases. The battle scenes become more intense. Hashtag no ship, hashtag Vikings. And Christian Callahan says, I fucking love Ivar sitting there bloody faced and clapping like a Norwegian Chucky. Hashtag no ship. Norwegian Chucky. Yeah, he does have a face that can go from childlike to maniacal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maniacal, I mean, child.
Yeah, they really did. And they amped up the blood this season, you know, where you're seeing like arrows and eyes. And but he's right. They mm-hmm. they really stepped up their game in the fight for sure.
Yeah, well, somehow the blood on Ivar's face was impervious to rain falling. And yeah, it seemed to increase in volume.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, did he cut himself on the head with that fall? Is that like
he pulled that old wrestling trick with the razor blade? He just kind of, all right, this is going to work. I need a distraction.
And when they lit the soldiers on fire. Yeah, that did you guys hear the C-3PO in there?
No.
There was like one of the guys that does the, you know, that same.
No, I missed it.
Yeah, there's a high-pitched scream in there, which is understandable.
Oh, yeah.
I can't even
imagine. I don't want to think about the noises that would come out of my mouth if you set me on fire.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
All right. So now we're back to discussing the Vikings post-battle. After the battle, Ube says to the room, we did well, brothers. Ivar can't help himself. And he says, it was my strategy. Ube says that what is important now is to discuss what to do next. Ube wants to make peace and begin farming, so therefore it is time to negotiate. Ivar disagrees, stating this was one battle within an overarching war. He warns ominously against any attempt to negotiate. So Ube and Fitzurk set off to negotiate with regret.
I feel like when Ivar said that, like, it would be a bad idea to negotiate with them. He wasn't talking about the result of the negotiations. He was talking about, it would be a bad idea for you to defy me and go do this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he knew that that's, because the other two brothers don't recognize his authority. You know, it's mm-hmm. still this triumvirate, or supposedly, you know what I mean? Even though he's the only one who's coming up with the really good battle plans like that. And they're, you know, what's Ube's idea? I like him as a character, but what's his idea? Well, yeah, we just whipped their ass. Now let's go sue for peace and try to talk about farmlands.
And
like, are you crazy?
I see why they're doing it, because they want to be like their dad. And it's worked in the past. But I think Ivar understands that we've already killed two kings. This isn't going to go quietly. Before, they would raid and then get land. Now, they've kind of amped up the stakes a bit. You know, we've wiped out one beloved king and another king that, you know, is just over there that nobody liked anyway. But it's still important to the church also. So Ivar, because I was like, Ube, I was like, yeah, it's the perfect time to go and get peace and get some farmland. And then, you know, of course, we see what happens. And it's like, oh, yeah, duh. they've kind of like crossed some serious lines on both sides. Even when they killed Ragnar.
See the reaction. Yeah, when you see the reaction of the English, you're just like, yeah, why wouldn't they react like that? That's kind of a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna give our lands over to you.
Yeah, Ivar's got his head on, and you know, eye on the prize.
At times.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, when it comes to fighting, you know, he's good.
Yes, he's a great great tactician for sure.
Yeah, if it's bloodshed, he definitely has his eye on the prize.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of what you guys were, you know, discussing with the English, the Saxons, the event of Ube and Fitzurse going to negotiate is actually our final scene with the Saxons. And this is where an editing choice happens that was a little bit bizarre, where they reveal the outcome of what happens. And they undermine the telling of the story, and it makes it the flow a bit cumbersome as well. So I was wondering why they did that. Why? And I think I know, but it doesn't really make it any better.
Go ahead.
So I'll clarify by just explaining the rest of the scene first. The negotiation scene unfolded with Ube's proposal of peace and also wanting to go ahead and get the land that they were promised. Haemon responds with spitting. After Ube and Fitzurse are escorted out, Alfred demonstrates his already burgeoning skill and leadership. Aethelwulf seems agreeable and pleased with Alfred's perspective. Haemon appears agreeable, but his actions prove otherwise when he handle whips Ube with a restrained Fitzurse to watch. Before Ube and Fitzurse are released with their tails between their legs, Haemon warns Ube about God seeing all, the good and the evil. We have like a quick scene before all this takes place where we see Ivar confronting Ube and Fitzurse because they have failed with their negotiation. They're all bloodied. He's asking if they're thirsty. And this is where we first see those crosses looming behind Ivar. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they maybe wanted to establish that vision in our minds when we have Haemon later talk about the all-seeing God, seeing the good and the evil that's happening. Because then again, we cut back to Ivar, and then the gleaming cross windows are looming behind him again, maybe to prove this point.
That's cool.
Maybe there's some other better reason than that.
No, I like that.
And I think they're also, because there was another editing choice that they made earlier when, after the slave girl had visited Ivar, and then we go to the Saxons, and they're doing their preparations for battle, and that scene ends with Haemon saying, "May the Lord be with us," and then they do a quick cut to Ivar, and he's still on that throne, and he's still reeling from that visit with the slave girl. Like, he believes that the gods are with him. So it's like this purposeful look at how these two opposing forces feel about their divinity and how they're supported by that divinity or whatever. It's almost like they're two scenes that are kind of like taken out of the flow of the story and is set as like tent posts to kind of like keep the overarching theme.
Yeah, it ruins the flow. And you sap out my criticism of this is that you sap out any of the tension that could be built up. If you told the story in a linear fashion, they go to the camp, they try to sue for peace, and then all of the stuff happens and you have them out there and you don't know, you haven't seen that other scene yet where Ivar's going, "Oh, are you guys thirsty? Your plan failed, blah, blah, blah." So you don't know that they survived. So you're thinking that easily Fitzurse could get it.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? And the tension just rises up and you're like, "Oh crap, here we go. Is somebody else going to die?" And then they don't, and then we can go on with the show. But as it is, you already know that these guys nothing more than getting beat up is really going to happen to them. And that's a really odd choice, because even with that explanation, I feel like that's, like you said yourself, it's not enough to really justify doing that and take away that suspense that you could have built up.
Yeah, and I don't even know that that's the explanation. That's all I could come up with as to why you would do that.
It works it works as an explanation, though, because it doesn't make sense. At least that makes it palatable. You know, it's like, okay, that I can see them trying to do that. It still sucked because the only thing that moved me was when, you know, you see them running like a couple kids back home. You know, it's like, oh, come on, guys. You know, your brother was right. Y'all did well with your tail between your legs. Yeah, at least walk, you know, walk. But then, you know, it was like, come on, fuck.
Have a little dignity. Like, wait till you get past all the soldiers, then run.
Yeah, something. I can almost imagine them crying when they got out of earshot. Like, you know, they're so mean to us. We just wanted to, you know. So, yeah, I agree.
They're so lucky they didn't have any witnesses of that. Mm-hmm. So lucky.
Oh, yeah.
So, as to the question of Alfred's leadership, and is there, like, why did they go, and whose decision was it to, you know, let them go? Like, who? Because if Alfred is ostensibly showing a little bit of leadership muscle and says, well, we need to be kind and merciful and not kill them, because that's what the Lord would have wanted, right? And Haman's like, yeah, gritting his teeth. And then you see Aethelwulf kind of go, yeah, he smiles and he's like, sure. So this is what happened, I think. I think they said, yeah, we're going to do what the kid says. We're going to go by the Lord's rule and we're going to be kind and merciful and let them live. But we're going to let the adults handle this and we're going to make them pay at the same time for coming in here trying to pull this bullshit. So yes, they get to live, but they get to learn a lesson too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so Alfred, you can go actually fight a real war, but we're going to let you play at king right now. Like,
oh,
this
yeah,
is
definitely.
Just, oh, that's definitely. So lame.
It was a complete condescending move and it was kind of justified because Alfred doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground. Yeah, you walk to Rome and back. Good for you. But I mean, you're still a kid, basically. You know what I mean? Leave the leading to the adults until you're an adult, right? You know what I mean? You don't make somebody a manager on their second day. I mean, you know, I don't know. Maybe you could see it as a dick move on their part, but the looks that were exchanged and I think that Haman and Aethelwulf were of the same mind on this, and they were like two hands working at the same time, and they just did that. That's how I
saw
it.
Plus, if you killed them, you would kind of make them martyrs also. But you send them back beat up like that, their plan worked because it kind of shamed them, not knowing that Ivar was going to kind of help their plot out because he wants them gone too. You know, so it worked on both fronts, on both sets of kids, you know?
That's a great point because think about this. You have two dead Vikings. Whoop-de-freaking-do. You still got an army on the other side of the hill. You have two Ragnar sons who you just made look like punks. Bitches in front of your whole army. Think of the morale boost that gives the English, the Saxons.
Oh, absolutely.
Those guys are not sleeping that night. They're like, yeah, you know, they're doing push-ups out in the field right now, ready for that next fight. So that was pretty genius because at first I thought, like, why wouldn't they kill them? They have them right there, but that was like, that was a really good move on their part. Uh-huh. So these are some very worthy adversaries at a time where the Vikings' leadership is fractious at best.
Yeah. I like that. So maybe they'll shoot their arrows next time at Ivar.
Right.
Something. Possible. Boom. Possible. Yeah.
So after this blunder of Ube's and Fitzurk, Ivar wants to be recognized as the leader of their great army. Ube can't accept it being an older brother. Ube has little support among their men, so he opts to go back and retake Kattegat. Ube says that their father would have hated Ivar for sundering and ripping the family apart, basically. And Ivar says, I don't think so. I did think about what Ragnar would be. I think he would be happy with all of them, mostly. Maybe not Vidzirk, but Ragnar always wanted to be a farmer, ultimately. And he even told Lagertha when he basically said his goodbye to her, their last scene together, that he regrets ever leaving the farm. And I think that regret probably, you know, encompasses everything that's been brought to start to dismantle the Viking culture as a result of the exposure to the Saxons. So I think he would actually be on board with Ivar destroying that.
Okay, I can see that. Like, let that cleansing fire kind of go through it and then learn the lesson and move on.
Yeah, because in the end, I think he was over them. He was no longer fascinated with the Christians.
Yeah, that kind of wore off after Athelstan.
The threat was empty because all Ivar has to tell him is, look, our dad left us for a decade or two, you know, so what would he care if we fractured the family up anyway?
Yeah, that was the fact that you guys exist is based off the fact that he fucked up a family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So, but it's indicative of how each one of them is thinking, because I mentioned in an earlier podcast how, like, each one of his sons seems to embody a certain element of him, and they take that and just kind of run with it to the max. So each one of them is going to have an idea in their head of what dad would have wanted us to do. So for Ube, it's always going to be the farming. He's never going to shut up about the farms. And for Ivar, it's always going to be, you know, pillage and kill. For Fitzurk, who knows what Fitzurk is thinking? You know, it's different every day. So, you know, hey, one day I'm just going to kind of go with Ube, and then the other day I'm going to stay with Ivar, and, you know.
Yeah.
Who knows? I'm not sure what quality he got from his dad.
Indecision? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure either.
I had joked about it before, like he got the lust part of it. You know, he just wants to go spend time with the ladies. But yeah.
He takes after his mom. It's all right.
Yeah. Yeah. He just, that's it. There you go. He's not taking after his dad at all. He's taking after Aslaug. He's like, I just want a drink. What's the problem? Mm-hmm. Let's just get crunked, you know?
The final scene is Ube's departure. Ube's and not Fitzurk's departure, actually, because Fitzurk changes his mind and steps off the boat to go stand with Ivar after Ivar had been taunting them from the shore. The last line is Ivar saying, "You see, everyone is with me."
Yeah.
So he, I mean, I guess like Fitzurk was the final thing he needed to feel.
It's just another jab like he into whole his brother. Or something. You know, it's like another jab into his brother because he was using like Viking peer pressure. Like, oh, you guys are weak. You guys are leaving. You're a bunch of pussies. And then finally his brother gets off. So in his mind, it's a victory of, oh, see, Ube, you do what you want and leave. Even our brother realizes he needs to follow me. You know, now all the men behind him see a Ragnarsson turn and follow Ivar. So it's like another chink in that, another link in that armor that he needs.
So does Ube embody all the negativity that Ivar has experienced in his life? Like Ube is like kind of like the representation of that.
He's disappointed that his brother's isn't backing him up. You know, he wants to be accepted so bad, and he treats him like a, you know, like most little brothers. So it's, I think anybody who disagrees with Ivar, even Floki, he's going to stand up and fight his point even more so than any other Viking because he feels like he has to, you know, because of his situation with his legs. So I think he just kind of goes all in no matter what, you know, like, you're not going to talk me out of it. This is how I feel. You know, this is, you're not, I can't show any kind of weakness. So even if it had been, he even fought Bjorn last season, he wasn't afraid to stand up to Bjorn and tell him what he thought. So I don't think it's just Ube. I think it's anybody who disagrees with him. Like, I'm not going to show weakness on anything.
Well, I think, you know, the idea of impotence, it's literal and figurative with him too, because of people placating him so much and pitying him and everything. And if you feel like you have that lower ceiling that's applied to you where, people either tell you you can't do this thing, or there's the idea that's even implanted in your head that you can't do these things.
You internalize it.
It's internalized, and that rage just fucking builds, you know? And then you just like fucking banshee screaming in people's faces.
You know, you think about it, Ube had to leave. They had to part company at some point because Ube said it himself. He said, "I'm the older brother and I can never ever accept your leadership because of that." So, which is kind of trite anyway, because they're not really so far in difference of age that it would really matter. If one person is better suited for leadership and has better ideas, which Ivar kind of does, at least in the warfare sense of things, then let it go, you know?
I think, well, see, Fitzurk had made a comment either in episode 1 or episode 2 of this season, how about Ivar being the leader of the army is unacceptable, in a way saying like socially it's not. So so I think it's actually very humiliating for Ube
to have Fitzurk get off the boat.
Basically, again, he's having to run away with his tail between his legs on this boat to go to Kattegat because he has just been beaten by his little brother into leadership position.
If there's a loser of this episode besides the guys who got stepped on with the spikes, then it's Ube.
Yeah,
for sure.
Oh yeah,
yeah, he's gonna have to rally back and get a turnaround, and I'm hoping whatever, I hope he just doesn't try to storm Kattegat with a boat full of people. It'd be the stupidest idea ever. But, you know,
I think, like you said, him being kind of like Ragnar with the farming sense, but also the compassion in the episode before when they're in the cathedral and they're slaughtering and killing, he was a lot like Ragnar where he's walking through the first time and just kind of witnessing these things. So I think that compassionate side of him is there also. I think he'll go back and just kind of take a deep breath. I don't think he's going to try and take Kattegat with two ships. I think he knows that would be a folly, you know. So maybe he'll go back and align himself with Lagertha and just kind of go from there, you know. I hope.
Like he was aware of a different element besides just like crush, kill, destroy.
Yeah, which is what I think pushed him into hopefully trying to get a peaceful resolution, even though without thinking it through, like at least I did, you know, or like his brother and I was in the same boat as him, you know.
I can see where Ube's coming from and wanting to get the land and farm on it, because that still needs to happen, because the problem that Ragnar had seen, that there's not enough arable land over there in Scandinavia and they have to branch out, is still there. It's just that he's trying to push it at the wrong times with the wrong people.
Yeah.
You know, they just need to carve out a section of northern England for themselves and then just be like, look, we're here and we're going to put up a wall of defenses between us and the South. And we're just going to do our farming thing that way. Don't like try to get peace accords and land packs and things
just
like that. Just take
England
it
all together, you know, go to Spain
or
Bjorn.
Or go. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, at some point, they are actually going to start getting land that's going to be given to them legally, in theory. Like, there's something's going to happen where they're supposed to have land because of a land grant, and then there's some shenanigans that are happening on the Saxon side, but the Vikings are going to figure out how to, like, mess around. It's this whole elaborate trick that happens in the sagas that's actually really funny. So I'm curious as to how they're going to... Because it's unrealistic as how it happens in the
It sounds like,
saga.
Like a tall tale.
Yeah, yeah, extremely. But it'll be interesting how they
so they're probably gonna
relay that
they're going to tackle that in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, they're going to interpret it.
All right, so anything else, or should we just move into feedback?
No, feedback.
Oh, yeah, and there's one more hashtag no shit before we go into feedback. And Christian Callahan says, I guess the name of this season is hashtag brutality, hashtag no shit.
Hashtag brutality. That sounds like a death metal band.
Which, you know, there is, you know, brutality that's obvious with the pits of spikes and burning people alive. But you also have the brutality between brothers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The emotional brutality. The
humiliation.
All right. First up. First piece of feedback up is PB&J. He says, hey guys, I just got finished listening to the podcast and I'd like to offer up some information. You were wondering if lying prostrate on the ground is a common thing in modern churches. Years ago, I worked for a company owned by Benedictine monks. The company was actually on the grounds of the monastery, so I had quite a bit of interaction with the monks. I recall many times watching the monks and priests lying prostrate before the altar, sometimes for quite a long time during various masses and observances. You are correct that they feel this action demonstrates total submission before God. As far as Haman running through the thorns, that was an attempt at absolution and penance for his perceived sin. This is similar to Aethelwulf's flagellation with the whip we've seen in the past. Both guys suffer from Catholic guilt over sin and the fear they will be judged lacking before a righteous God. They make themselves suffer as Christ suffered before the cross, hoping this will appease God's wrath. Aethelwulf's mentioning of sin to Judith wasn't a casual dig at her, but a very real fear of God's vengeance on them and his people. Anyway, great show as usual. Take care, PB&J.
Cool.
So that is a thing, then, lying prostrate like that.
Oof. Yeah, so were you having to step over them sometimes? Like, if you're, like, on your way to do a task, and you're like, oh, oops, sorry, excuse me.
I would be so nervous trying to step. I would end up, like, tripping or stepping on something. It would be awful.
You know who has it bad is the janitor there at the monastery. Be like, hey, Father Dickhead, can you move? Can you get out of the way? I'm trying to mop this floor. Jesus Christ.
The monk gets like wet strands of mop up his nose.
I told you to move, buddy. I told you to move.
Yeah, and that's something that I both Aethelwulf and Haman share in common as far as their religious belief. And we didn't really see much with Judith here, so I'm not really quite sure if they're going to play with that idea of Haman maybe kind of starting to hit on her or something like that. But I think we're going to see that because he had that look on his face when he was introduced to her.
Yeah, he can't help it. Haman's a horn dog. He's going to try to get Judith in the bath at some point.
Thank you, PB&J, and I know we're going to hear from you again here in a minute. Next up, we have Benny Jessica. And Benny Jessica says, hi, so great to listen to you again. I was afraid that my interest in Vikings would end in the snake pit with rags, but the show is still worth watching. Harold, when he asked Joan Jett to marry him, said something like, I chose to kidnap you because you're most likely to marry me, or did I mistake your character? I think Harold sees Joan Jett's ambition. She's sleeping with both the queen and the crown prince. She wants power. I think she will say no to Harold for a while because she has invested so much in getting to the top, whichever one of Lags or Bjorn who stay there, but she will come around and marry Harold. What I really, really dislike about the show now are all the pretty women with perfect braids and eyeliner. They are little warrior dolls. Hurst needs to age Lags and mess up the chicks a bit. Give them some scars or whatever. Or he needs to show them pampering at the Kattegat spa because they look like they hang out there a lot.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Em's right. The show is missing heart and all other of Ragnar's body parts. Lags is now a rapist who shoots people in the back. Bjorn has always been a little a-hole. Siggy, the Ragnarsson characters are flat. They are evil and are stupid. Maybe Ube might be an exception. The ones who show a little bit of heart are Harold. His women issues makes him vulnerable. He just needs a little bit of love and butterflies in his tummy. And A-Wolf, he has always cared for his whole abusive a-hole family. The cheating wife, the bastard son, and the emotionless father. Harold and A-Wolf are the ones I'm rooting for this season. Lagertha is actually in her 50s at this point, and she does not look near 50 at all. So, and I have that Vikings podcast that I mentioned. They had, oh God, now I can't remember his name. And they actually based their accents on the way he spoke. And he was adamant about not wearing makeup and things like that. But once he left the show, that started to change. And there was some arguments about, you know, how some of the women feel that they need to do it because of their career. And, you know, a lot of their career is based on how they look and things like that. And there is truth to that. You know, as far as what's historically accurate and realistic, makeup isn't.
Yeah, because they made Travis Fimmel look like he was 70 just about at the end of his.
Yeah.
It wouldn't take much, but they've never aged any of the women, it seems, in any season.
No, they just let them be pretty, you know? They just, and they, like, I didn't really notice that, but what Em says is true. They have gotten more and more done up, and the braids get more elaborate, and the makeup looks like they just got out of, you know, the MAC. And so it's, you know, they're just like, wow.
But, sorry.
Go ahead. No, I'm done.
It was Johan Rink that was interviewed. So he was the one who said that. I mean, wouldn't it be more interesting if Lagertha looked like she was in her 50s?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it wouldn't be a bad thing because it's not like, well, I don't want to. What I was going to say is it wouldn't be a bad thing because it's not like you're just suddenly unattractive just because you're not in your 20s anymore or even your 30s anymore or something like that. You know what I mean? It's make a person look like the character's supposed to look. How about that?
I agree.
Yeah, that's the best way you can say it.
However, I did like the braids. I thought they were really cool, but I imagine it's probably unrealistic. And who has time to not only actually make those braids, but to sit in the chair so somebody does it for you, you know, in real life? Like, are you getting up at 2 a.m. just to get your hair done, you know, and are they wearing caps on their head to protect their braids when they're sleeping?
Well, I think they employ, I've read this somewhere, they employ a whole team of Ewoks to do the braiding of their hair.
Nub, nub.
Like, you know, They're hard to, you know, give stage direction to. You need to move them around and get them off or whatever.
Well, they just lay down and they look like all the other pelts. So, they, you know, if they're in the scene, they just lay down.
The sound guy has a bitch of a time, though, because everything will be going fine. And then you hear, yep, yep. And then she's just like, all right, cut.
And I do agree that Joan Jett, also known as Astrid, is ambitious. But I think she's discerning, though, as far as like who she aligns herself with. Mm-hmm. So at least I want to believe that.
I agree. And I think the jury's out for Harold. And he hasn't made that great of an impression at this point. Basically, you bring me into a dirty town and a dirty hall, and then you put me in a bedroom and you try to come in there and get fresh with me and then laugh. So we'll see where this goes. Thank you, Jessica.
Yes, thank you, Ben and Jessica.
Up next is PB&J again. He says, hey guys, I was totally absorbed by this episode. He's talking about the current one at this point. Here are some of my observations. Theme of the episode, juxtaposition, war versus peace. Ivar and Haman love war. Ube and Floki desire peace. Dreams versus reality. Ube dreams of peace and a return to the land, but reality draws him to war and humiliation. Floki dreams of an end and death, but reality draws him to a beginning and life. Harold dreams of love, but reality gives him hate and a broken nose. Ivar seemed genuinely moved by the slave girl's pronouncement of his greatness. Mm-hmm. Someone finally acknowledged what he always believed about himself. He is destined for greatness. Finally, I think we can all agree on this. Ivar is a total, complete badass of the highest order. What a magnificent madman. Shine on, you crazy diamond. I'm so encouraged our show will survive the post-Ragnar reality. I thought it was fantastic. That is all. PB&J.
I like how you call them a crazy diamond. I'm not quite there yet where I feel he's a total complete badass, but I'm, you know, getting there. I'm liking him more. I definitely understand where he's coming from, and I like that he's a great tactician.
They've done a good job at the first part of this season to get you to understand his motivations of where he's coming from. That little bit of humanizing element, it goes a long way you know, so.
But I like how you brought up these juxtapositions, especially Harold dreaming of love, but reality gives him a hate. Thank you, PB&J. Up next is Mutz, and Mutz says, so disappointed in the lame battle at York. The scene with Ivar laying on the ground just screaming like an annoying brat was just too much for me. Not worthy of any son of Ragnar. Almost wanted to turn the TV off. Shame the Saxons if they let him get away with that in any battle. I hate this character, and not because I'm supposed to. He is just a spoiled, over-the-top, preppy ass, not a Viking, and just a deranged Norse serial killer. Disgusting.
And we have a downvote for Ivar.
Right. I'm surprised, but it's interesting to hear this side of it.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't too into that scene just because it just seemed like somebody should have tried to take him out a little bit more than they did.
It'd be funny if they had shushed him every time. Shh.
But, shh. I'm trying to yell very loud. Fitzurk and Uber being mean to me. I don't have a T-shirt that says Team Ivar or anything like that, but I can't go with you here. I don't feel like he's that bad, but hey, it's an opinion and it's yours, and you're letting us know. Thank you.
Yeah, and keep letting us know how you feel, and if your feelings change, especially
they will.
Thank you, Mutz.
All right, up next is Dunkin' Donuts. She says, hey guys, I'll be honest, this episode was not my favorite. Good points. The battle, sound engineering, and makeup department were top notch. As an ophthalmology editor in my, quote, real life, I kept obsessing over the realistic-looking eye injuries. Ivar's evil laugh made me giggle, and the scene where the soldiers have to step over the guys stuck on the spikes was so good and gross. Even Astrid, God's help me, was kind of amazing compared to Harald's people, which just made me realize how perfect Lagertha and Torvi are in comparison. Bad points. Uba's complete lack of perspective and consistency. Then he takes his forces, which is apparently 20 people, home. Okay, lol.
Poor Uba.
Vitzerk, get your own character, dude.
I know, he was starting to, like, I think developed just a little bit in episode 1 and 2, and then now he's back to the plus one of last season.
Hopefully now that Ube's not around, he won't just become like a lackey to Ivar. You know, maybe he can develop in his own way, but no. Like with it seemed like the Ivar and Ube going back and forth, and there wasn't room for Fitzurk to develop much of a character, so now maybe there will be a little bit of room, hopefully.
He's just going to get killed.
Yeah, he's next. He's next. He's mm-hmm. the expendable. Harold looked like a big dope at home. He's a king. No woman wants him. How? Artificial drama. Why is it important to hide who sanctioned throwing Ube out of the Saxon camp? They can't show us and still hold the consequences till next episode. The editing in that section was just weird and unnecessary.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I feel bad for Alexander Ludwig and his 30 seconds of screen time, and I don't have a lot of hope for his character improving based on the lack of lines last season. We still don't even know why he was sleeping with Astrid.
And Donuts, you mentioned in your last feedback about Ludwig mugging, and I totally understood what you were saying when I was watching him on this episode.
Yeah. When he's talking about being naked, he's just like, it's like his facial expression is an exclamation point on the sentence. It's just like,
He's trying too hard to be like Fimmel.
She goes on to say, the one thing this cast is missing is levity. No matter what was going on, Ragnar had a lightness of heart that set mm-hmm. everyone else in motion. Everyone here is just too damn serious. Even poor Sinric looked worn down and sad. Hoping next week is better script-wise, the donuts. Well, the honesty here in the letters tonight are a beautiful thing.
Yes, that's what we want.
Nobody had any like other ideas, though, like writing in. I'm kind of surprised. Where did Sinric come from? Everybody chime in on that next week. Thank you, Donuts.
Yes, thank you, Donuts, as always. Up next is our last piece of feedback, and we have Dahlia General. And she says, hi, M, Steve, and Paul, question mark?
I'm here.
Skull!
He's here.
So great to have Vikings back, and more importantly, the Wild Hunt family. I like this episode, but no Lagertha? Boo! A couple of quick thoughts. I always find it so amusing that everyone wears a helmet, even Ivar, except for our heroes. I know, it's so we can identify Dreamwolf, Ube, Me Too, and Headman, since I think that's a more appropriate name for him in the fray. But was that really practical, or is it showing what badass warriors they were? While I too am sick of seeing Ivar's molars and sinister sneer, I gotta give it to Alex in the scene where the slave is brought to him and she recognizes and praises his being different. She seemed sincere. I really felt the vulnerable little boy inside him, and it gave me a glimpse of how Ivar's really never had anyone on his side believing in him. Don't get me wrong, he's still dangerous and violent, but a brilliant tactician and perhaps more than a little misunderstood. Halfdan's theory on living life to the fullest. Aces. We should all be so wise and so lucky. I love the nuanced detail that Jordan Patrick Smith as Ube displays. He has picked up so many of Travis's mannerisms that it really is remarkable. I love it. I found it interesting at the end that Hearst allowed the viewer to see both Ube's side and Ivar's side, and both were reasonable. I also found it interesting that both brothers had a wounded, albeit not blinded, eye. Do you think he was suggesting that both in their own way were like Odin, giving up an eye for knowledge? Discuss. Until we raid again, Dahlia General.
Salute to the general. Salute. All right, so what do you think about the eye stuff?
Weren't they opposite? That it wasn't.
Yeah, I want to say it was Ivar's left eye and Uba's right eye that were really jacked up. Uh-huh. I think.
Not sure. I'm just not sure on that.
Yeah, I think. Don't quote me on that. I could be wrong because I wasn't really.
Not that that matters.
Yeah, but.
But I guess. Yeah, I mean, definitely. Like they both got some sort of knowledge. I think
it's a cool nod to that. Mm-hmm. If anything, I don't know if they directly got anything out of it to where you know. I mean, Ube knows that he's going back to Kattegat with nobody really following him. And so he knows where his place is in that, you know, structure.
Was the knowledge he got, you think, was some sort of like humbling he needed?
Possibly. Yeah.
And then Ivar got that faith in himself, maybe?
Yeah, could.
Ivar got the eye of the tiger.
But, you know, with Ube, you brought up how he's picked up so many of Travis's mannerisms. And I thought it was really noticeable when it was that scene where he was up standing, I think, talking about negotiation, expressing how they should do that. I think it was...
Oh, after the battle?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's when it was. I know he was standing up, walking around, gesturing quite a bit, but his voice, not only the way he moved, but his voice sounded a lot like Ragnar. And that was pretty impressive.
Yeah, I kind of feel like Ube's doing that. Trying to channel Ragnar with a good degree of success.
Economically.
Economically. Bjorn is doing it maybe not so much to a degree of success. And I think Fitzurk is just kind of like not trying.
Fitzurk is just bellowing.
Yeah. Fitzurk's the mailman's kid. That's like...
No, Harbard. Harbard's kid.
Harbard. Yeah. Yeah, Harbard had a visit that wasn't on screen way before. You know what I mean? We just didn't know about it. It's in the expanded universe material. So, all right. Well, thank you, Dahlia. And that concludes our feedback for the night. And I would like to thank everybody who has been writing in feedback for doing it in the first place. And secondly, for sticking to the kind of ground rules that we set about keeping it the bullet point style and a little bit shorter. So it really helps us out time-wise. So thank you very much.
And I want to give everybody advance notice as far as like feedback writing, because on the week of the 20th, when Vikings airs on the 20th, we're actually going to record that Thursday on the 21st. So if you want to get your feedback in, then please get it in on Thursday by 7:00 Eastern Standard Time, because the next day my brother's going to be in town and I'm going to party. And also, just to let you guys know, just because we're recording it earlier, it doesn't mean I'll be releasing it earlier. It still won't be released till Saturday, but I'll talk about it again next week as a reminder.
Right on. All right. So this concludes our coverage of Season 5, Episode 3, Homeland of the Vikings. So this has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
Good night. All right, ready? Shield time.
Axe time?
Sword
Shields
time.
Shields are splintered.
There we go. All right, let's start it over. Sword time.
Is it axe time?
Yeah. All right, axe time.
Sword time.
Shields are splintered.
It still sounds wrong, but I'm not one to know that, so it'll work. I always fucked it up.
Faces
anyway.
Impaled by spikes.
Yeah, impaled. We're going to do a new one. Impaled by spikes.
In the face and throat.